In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a man who claims to have eaten candy every single day of his entire life. And after you read his book, newly published book, titled Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America, I think you will be inclined to believe him. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. It is in part a memoir of his own personal candy obsession, but it's also about the industry, the candy industry, about how it is that candy bars come to be and why it is that sometimes they become extinct, and about the great battle that is waged between smaller candy makers and the big three, Mars, Hershey, and Nestle. Steve Almond is his name, and it is, in fact, his real name. He teaches creative writing at Boston College and also occasionally is a commentator on the NPR affiliate in Boston, WBUR. And he's talking with us by telephone. In the introductory section of the book, in the prologue to the book, among the things he says about himself, in addition to the information that he's had candy every day of his life, also you will learn that the author thinks about candy at least once an hour, he says, and that the author has between 3 and 7 pounds of candy in his house at all times. We'll go on from there. Questions and comments, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455, if you would like to call in. Well, Steve Almond, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We appreciate it. The book is tremendous fun to read, and I say that as someone who is not a candy freak. last piece of candy I ate, somebody a couple of weeks before Christmas gave me a Dove bite, and I think that was it. And it may not be till next Christmas till I have any more, and I wouldn't feel any great loss. But but for people who are candy freaks, and you know who you are, I'm sure that you would enjoy the book. And even if you're not, I think it's a lot of fun. And it's fascinating to read about candy and how it's created, and also some of the realities of the business, particularly this business of smaller companies trying to compete with these giant companies.
Sure. Yeah, the big three are, I'm disturbed, obviously, to hear that you're not a candy freak, but I think we'll be able to work through it.
I hope so. We'll be able to find some common ground.
Well, the thing is that for me, even if you're not a candy fan, the story of candy is really the story of America in the 20th century. That is to say, it's the story of consolidation of the few powerful, essentially putting out of business or buying out the many small, of the movement from regional and civic identity and a connection with the commodities that we wear and eat every day, becoming much more and more distanced and abstracted. And so I think actually people, for instance, if they work in a bookshop, can relate to what's happened with candy. They see Barnes & Noble and Borders kind of taking over and the small indies kind of being pushed to the fringes. Same thing has happened essentially with every industry. The sort of strange local and regional companies essentially being absorbed by the Walmarts, the McDonald's, the Coke and Pepsis of the world. So in that way, even if you're not particularly candy freakish, there is something about America that I hope folks will take away from the book.
Yeah. Well, and it also seems to be the case, and you certainly are the man who would know, that as candy becomes more of a mass-produced item, that the quality of the product suffers.
Well, I don't want to be too reflexive in that. Mm. The reason being that really the way candy existed, and I focused on candy bars because, just for a little bit of background, the candy bar is a uniquely American cultural artifact. It is our culinary jazz, though that's probably heresy to anybody who's a fan of, Charlie Parker and Miles Davis. But I think it is this thing that came about and was created and popularized in America and has gone forth from there. In fact, I know it is. Candy bars, after all, in the candy and chocolate in a bar form didn't exist really until the 1850s. Henri Nestlé is over in Switzerland experimenting, and previous to that, it was something that was in liquid form mostly. You go back and look at Hogarth's prints of the chocolate parlors where people would have, would have these, essentially like a very rich cocoa, not very sweet, and it was something that was almost exclusively consumed by the aristocracy. And what you see is a gradual democratization. Henri Nestlé puts puts chocolate into the bar form, and then in the late 19th century, in 1893, Milton S. Hershey goes to the World's Fair, sees a German exhibit of candy bars being made, sees the beautiful chocolate washing down, smells the aroma, tastes the bar, and says, "This is the future freak of America. This is the next great snack product." And he essentially sets about creating a milk chocolate bar, what we know of today as Hershey's chocolate, and takes chocolate bars from confectioner shops where they had existed, that is, candy factories, and puts them in push carts, grocery stores, pharmacies. So suddenly we see that candy bars start to become proliferated. And then the real boom, and I'm giving a little bit more history than you need, but I found it fascinating because I didn't know any of this stuff previously. I assumed, like most people, oh, candy bars have always existed. You know, prehistoric man probably ate them. In fact, it was the doughboys in World War I, the soldiers, who were the first mass consumers of candy bars. They were produced as a single-serving unit, really, to give quick energy to the troops. When they came back to the United States, they went, hey, where are these incredible things that we would eat? And a candy bar boom ensued in which literally tens of thousands of brands of candy bars were introduced. Now, the reason for that, and in fact, in the short history of candy bars, there have been an estimated 100,000 brands, which seems a little mind-boggling until you consider that every single city in America had their own confectioner. The bigger cities like Chicago and Boston and New York had literally dozens of confectioners, all of whom were cranking out a new brand every single season, some of them many new brands. And so you had this incredible proliferation of candy bar brands, but the reality was that there was so much less travel, and candy bars themselves couldn't be transported because there weren't good highway systems and there was no refrigeration. So people were really, if you know what I mean, eating the local brand, and they didn't know about the candy bars from other cities unless you were a traveling salesman or something with a sweet tooth. So even though there was this incredible diversity and so many more weird and wonderful ingredients, you know, pineapple and certainly Brazil nuts and, you know, chocolate-covered vegetables, and, I mean, just the strangest kind of candy bars you could imagine, really, unless you traveled around, you didn't experience the candy bar boom in real time. Now, what's happened as the big three have taken over and consolidated the business is that they've recognized that people want diversity and want variety, and they have done this very clever thing, which is essentially creating what's called brand extensions. So, for instance, you have Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, and then you have Hershey's realizing that the salesmen and the consumers want something new every season, so they introduce the white cup, the dark chocolate cup, the big cup, the crunchy cup, and on and on and on. So, you know, it's sort of the Hollywood sequel version of the candy bar world. You see all this proliferation of different bars, but the sad thing is that sometimes those brand extensions are better than the original bar, and I would cite here as my paramount example the Kit Kat Dark.
Oh, yes.
Kit Kat Dark. With dark chocolate, and it's a fabulous, fabulous bar. It's just the chocolate is very cream, tastes a little bit like chocolate pudding. It's got a little coffee overtone to it, and it melts. It's got a wonderful, what they call, mouth feel. It just feels great in the mouth. And they were introduced, but of course, the big companies have so much invested in their main brands that they don't want these offshoots to become more popular because they're essentially taking money out of their own pocket. You know, if you go and get addicted to Kit Kat Darks, as I did, then you're no longer eating Kit Kats, the main brand. So they introduce them for a limited period of time, and then they pull them off the shelves. And if you're somebody like me, you know, a hardcore candy freak, you wind up buying, you know, a case of 12 boxes of 36.
And you apparently weren't the only one. When it was introduced, people who discovered it, a lot of people discovered it, thought it was really wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
And then when the word got out there that there wasn't going to be any more, that people who were into this just went nuts and,
well, sure.
And said, you know, give me as many of them as you can.
I buy them by the box now when I see them. And this is really, this is to me kind of the Dow Jones of the oral experience in our culture is the candy world. The examples that I think of, you know, from my childhood are still very pointed. I can't see a package of Pop Rocks without thinking about the Pop Rocks freakout of the late 70s when these products first, you know, when Pop Rocks were first introduced. They're a candy basically that's, you know, all the staples, you know, sugar and flavoring and coloring, but they also have compressed carbon dioxide, so they pop in the mouth. They explode literally on your tongue, and this was a revolutionary if you were a 10-year-old kid. So there was an incredible run on Pop Rocks when I was growing up, and you couldn't find them, and there were people literally selling them out of the trunks of their cars, you know, kids who had sort of set up a black market. Same thing happened with Bubble Yum when that first came out, because it was so wildly popular, and there was this entire supply-demand freakout that would occur, and I think that still happens with candy. There's an entire cottage industry of online people who basically recognize when a brand is going to be discontinued or becomes harder to buy, becomes less available, and they buy up you know, a great quantity of it. And people like me who are freaks go online to try to find blackjack gum or whatever it is and are willing to pay a premium price. So there's an actual world of candy speculators out there.
Well, you in the book, I think, explained that part of this book was born because you liked a particular candy bar. And I think at this point you're talking about the Caravel.
Yeah.
You liked a particular candy bar that you thought was just fabulous and that it disappeared. And that does happen, that candy bars are there. I mean, obviously, a lot of them, if there were 100,000 of them at one time, and, you know, over time, they're not 100,000 now, that candy bars are here and then they're gone. And you sort of asked yourself, well, why does that happen? Why is it we have something here that I think is really good? No doubt a lot of other people think is really good. So why is it that why can't I have one?
Sure. Yeah, well, this is the thing. In fact, if you want, I can read you a little bit for people who might not remember the Caravel or remember it as vividly as I'm afflicted. I'm tempted to just read a little bit about it.
I wanted to ask you to, because I think one of the things I like about the book is your descriptions of candy. It's so rhapsodic. It's like, I guess, other kinds of food writing. It's wonderful to read people describing the experience. And this that really blew me away when I read it.
Good. Well, here's the Caravel. Well, here you go. The Caravel tasted more like a pastry. The chocolate was thicker, darker, full-bodied, and the crisp rice had a malty flavor and what I want to call structural integrity. The caramel was that rarest variety, dark and lustrous and supple, with hints of fudge. More so, there was a sense of the piece yielding to the mouth, by which I mean one had to work the teeth through the sturdy chocolate shell, which gave way with a distinct, moist snap, through the crisp rice, thus releasing a second grainy bouquet, and only then into the soft caramel core. Oh, that inimitable combination of textures, that symphony of flavors, and how they offer themselves to the heat and wetness of the mouth, the sensation of the crisp rice drenched in drenched in melted chocolate, chomped by the molars into the creamy swirl of caramel. Oh, woe and pity unto thee who never tasted this bar. True woe, true pity. So as you can tell, I get a little bit overwrought.
Well, I love that. And I think that's representative of some of the kind of writing that you'll find in the book, particularly as when you talk about the experience.
Particularly when it comes to candy bars.
When it comes to candy bars. Yeah, when we talk about the experience of the candy bar. I just love that. And I read it out loud to my wife last night. I said, here, you got to hear this. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Well, good. So maybe you're not a freak, but maybe she's a freak. Maybe at least married well and your kids stand a chance.
Well, she does like chocolate. That's for sure. I don't know if she would qualify as being a freak. Maybe. At certain times, maybe.
Well, my feeling is that everybody has a little freak in them. I'm really using that just as a kind of cutesy way to talk about obsession or, you know, passionate engagement would be a more euphemistic way of looking at it. And the truth of the matter is that everybody has something that they're obsessed about. And to me, as I realized in the course of writing this book, you know, that's really what people should be writing about and focusing on, not to the exclusion of, you know, paying the bills and paying attention to the people in their lives. But, you know, they tell us a lot about who we are. The more I looked at candy, which is my freak, the more I recognized how much candy was really, the story of candy and my memories of candy were really very much the story of my life and childhood, a kind of desperate need for love, and for self-love and a certain kind of sensual pleasure, and also a lot of feelings of deprivation that gave rise to that.
Yeah.
So when I was eating the caravel and remembering going to buy the caravel, it had a lot to do with feeling very lonely, feeling a little bit out of step with the rest of my family and kind of isolated and needing something that I could give myself. And that's why I think people remember the candy bars of their youth so vividly. I really do think, you know, the caravel, the Choco Light, the Marathon bar, you know, the no jelly bar. I remember these, you know, better in some sense better than I remember the people who I was playing soccer with, you know, when I was 12 years old or 13 years old or whatever. And I think that the reason for that is because candy really is the sort of sex, drugs, and rock and roll of childhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first transgressive pleasure, and it's also the first sort of act of self-love, and it's also the first economic empowerment, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody remembers, or most people remember, the first place where they went to go get candy, and the feeling of having 50 cents in your hot, sweaty little palm and thinking, now, with this, I can get lemon heads and jawbreakers and hot tamales and a caravel, you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess it did start me thinking when I was a kid, my dad, good guy and pretty indulgent parent, I remembered we would go to, it was a Walgreens. It was at a little shopping center not too far from where we lived. And it had a what now, as I think of, as being a very large candy aisle, a lot of stuff there. And my dad turned me on to Cadbury. And I think that I do remember that he bought me a Caramello, what they used to call them, the thing that's got chocolate and has this liquid sort of caramel inside and these little bricks that are made into the bar. And I think even then I knew when I tasted that chocolate, this something about this was a cut above a lot of the other stuff that was there. And I thought to myself, hey, this is pretty good, Dad. All right. Can we have some more of this?
Right.
And so, yeah, I guess
Everybody's got one in there, because I really do think it runs straight from the id to the candy bar to the memory banks. Also, people's sense memory is so strong when it comes to smell and taste. You know, that's why they used to perfume letters in the old days, you know, you're out on the frontier or whatever, and your wife or lover or whoever it is sends you a letter, and you know, you open the letter and you smell suddenly, and boom, you're hit with all the memories of spending time with that person. It really is a nostalgia trigger for people. And you know, the fact of the matter is that you happen to have had you liked the caramelized taste of Cadbury, which they heat the milk to a higher temperature. It tastes more like a caramel chocolate. But the truth is that, and I've realized this as this book has been in the world and I've traveled around talking with people about their likes and dislikes with candy, you can't really tell somebody else that their mouth is wrong. You know, as much as the French might poo-poo Hershey's chocolate and say, oh, it's barnyard chocolate, oh, it tastes like sour milk or whatever, hey, you can't tell somebody else their mouth is wrong. You know, you cannot say, I hate coconut. The texture to me is just loathsome. But there are plenty of otherwise rational people who love coconut. And I would never tell them that, you know, oh, you're wrong and that's no good. I would, in fact, say, great, please eat all the coconut and I'll, you know, leave the good stuff for me.
Yeah, save it for someone more deserving. We have a couple of callers here. I should introduce again our guest, Steve Almond. He teaches creative writing at Boston College and is the author of the book Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And it's a lot of fun, whether you are obsessed with candy or not, because it's both a memoir of his personal obsession with candy, but it's also some about the industry and where candy bars particularly come from, how they're produced, how people develop them, why it is that candy bars are here and then they're gone, and also particularly this real struggle that small regionally based manufacturers have as they try to compete with the enormous companies, the big three, Nestle, Hershey's, and Mars. We have a couple callers here. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line one first.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. Did chocolate become popular first in Holland? And the second one, more to the point, a broader question, what has it done to your weight?
Well, I appreciate your concern about my health. I'll handle the second one first. Since I am blessed, and I mean blessed, with a fast metabolism because I'm an ectomorph. And so what's happened to my weight is I'm a skinny guy, and now I'm a skinny guy with a little pot belly. I probably gained about 10 pounds on this book tour so far because everybody brings me their chocolate. And, you know, who am I to refuse? I want to try it. They want me to try it. So I consider it a professional duty. So I know it sounds tough, and I don't want people to feel too sorry for me, but I have been suffering from my art during this tour, and I have put on some weight.
Well, you're a lucky man. Well, I'll hang up and listen to your other answers.
Absolutely. Well, the interesting thing about, let me talk a little bit about candy's origins. All of Europe actually went mad for cocoa when it was originally introduced. It was given to Cortez from Montezuma, actually, you know, among his other dumb moves in trusting Cortez, was to give him cocoa, and it was brought back to the Spanish court where it was immediately a sensation. You have to understand, nobody had any idea that such an intoxicating flavor existed. And I want to say this about chocolate. It is the greatest, most complex, rich, fascinating, delicious flavor that has ever been, you know, that has ever come into being in the natural world. It has 1,500 distinct notes of roses and honey and even spoiled fish and all these different distinct flavor notes that without all of them, it wouldn't be chocolate. And so, for instance, flavorists these days can give us the taste of almost anything on earth, but they're nowhere close to coming up with a facsimile for chocolate. So the Europeans went mad for chocolate. In fact, it was somewhat of a state secret in the Spanish court. There was a great deal of desire to keep this secret under wraps, and it finally leaked word. You know, a kind of spy from Italy told the Italian government about this stuffed chocolate. And as with the other spices and flavors, sugar and coffee and tea, it really drove. It drove the imperialism of the New World. People forget that much of the engine of imperialism was really the desire for delicious flavors. You know, that is the amazing thing, is that people were, in the end, you'd think, well, you want glory and you want gold and silver and riches. What people really want is flavor, you know, especially during the centuries where salt was a fancy spice, if you know what I mean. So there was this insatiable drive to set up plantations and start to import cocoa into the European courts. I think it really became popular initially in Spain and then in Italy, and obviously France got into the picture. Now I would say that if you wanted to look at the capital of chocolate making, certainly Switzerland's up there. Germany has a great tradition. I would say Belgium is probably the place where there is per capita the most great candy, which is not to say that there isn't great candy all over Europe and the United States, for that matter. But just by way of saying that, you know, really, if you go to Belgium and you have breakfast there, you're going to have a cup of coffee and a square of chocolate. Now, for me, I would do away with the coffee, but that's me.
We have another caller here, and they're in Belgium, but it's Belgium, Illinois. So
I love it.
We'll go right here, line four. Hello.
Yes, I've been to the other Belgium, too. They do have tremendous chocolates. I would like to suggest you start a new book and talk about the most miraculous flavor also, which is the vanilla bean, which is also an orchid, which all has lots of interesting concepts about it, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, vanilla is a terrific, terrific spice. I use it. I use it in French toast. I think it's an amazing. In fact, let me recommend a bar if you're a vanilla guy. I have never understood, or I didn't understand until I started working on this book, the whole flavor trope of chocolate and vanilla. You know, it just seemed like kind of a cliche. But when I had a bar called the Vallow Milk, which is one of these regional bars that David mentioned, made by a small company called Cyphers in Kansas City or outside Kansas City. When I tasted that, I was blown away. Here's the bar. It's a candy cup, just like a Reese's peanut butter cup, but bigger. And it's a special chocolate that's especially velvety and creamy. He's had it, you know, specially designed. It's hand tempered. That is, it is mixed by hand, heated and cooled and mixed, instead of using big machines. And it's made in small batches, and it's a vanilla syrup in the middle of this that is uses real bourbon vanilla. This is the vanilla from the Isle of Madagascar that used to be the Isle of Bourbon, which is the capital of vanilla production. It's the place where the temperature and humidity is ideal for the growing of vanilla beans, and it's a sensational bar. If you're a vanilla person, you must try this piece.
If I might change your direction just slightly, you've been mainly talking just about commercially prepared bars. There are excellent candy companies around. I might also mention Mrs. C's from South San Francisco.
Sure.
Fabulous candy.
Yep.
Here locally, now you will not find it anyplace else. Mr. Inge and his wife probably haven't even eaten it yet. Right along the border here of Indiana, Illinois, which is I'm located at, small little town, there's a type of candy called Wolf's candy.
Huh.
Not Mrs. Wolf's, but Wolf's candy. Very, very, very regional. Phenomenal candy.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal.
I do talk in the book about, and this is thank you for bringing that up because and giving me a recommendation because I will track that down or they will track me down. But I do talk in the book about there really are two. There's the big three. There are these little regional candy bars that are still sort of clinging on to survival. And then there's a gourmet market that has emerged which is essentially, you know, chocolate that's made in small batches, very great attention to the quality and unfortunately, but inevitably, higher price. So Godiva is sort of the ones who realized that people would pay big money for chocolate. And essentially, it was sort of a return to the historical roots of chocolate as a gourmet luxury product for the aristocracy. And now there are just terrific companies producing really amazing pieces. I visited Lake Champlain and the chocolate engineer at Lake Champlain, which is up in Burlington, Vermont. But we could also look at Schaffenberger. You know, we could look at the beautiful thing is that this cottage industry has really risen up and that their gourmet chocolates are almost always, you know, superior to anything that the big three can produce because they just think about it more carefully. I feel like I maybe should read a little bit about a Lake Champlain chocolate bar. David, could I do that?
Oh, yeah, please.
Okay, because this is a great example of how carefully the bars are engineered. So I'm talking now about the five-star caramel bar, which is from Lake Champlain. I'm talking, a friend of mine brought me this bar, and it was so beautiful, actually. The wrapper was so beautiful that I was sort of frightened to open it. My friend had no such compunction. She unwrapped the caramel bar and took a bite. It was clear, simply from the way her mouth addressed the bar, that we were dealing with a different grade of freak. Her bite was smooth and concerted. There was an obvious density at play here, though interrupted by two muted snaps, both of which caused her a quarter moment of anguish, followed by a twinge of delight registered as a flushing upon her cheeks. She moaned. It was a lovely thing to hear. This reaction was, in my view, restrained. I'd never tasted anything like the five-star. Fancy chocolates, truffles, and so forth are one thing, but this was a fancy candy bar, a complex and nuanced marriage of ingredients. There was caramel, obviously, but also roasted almonds and nuggets of dark chocolate. It was draped in a thin layer of milk chocolate. The interplay of tastes and textures was remarkable. The teeth broke through the milky chocolate shell, sailed through the mild caramel, only to encounter the smoky crunch of the almonds, and finally the rich tumescence of the dark chocolate. You almost never see milk and dark chocolate commingled, but the effect in this bar was striking. The sweetness of the milk chocolate rushed across the tongue, played against the musky crunch of the nut, then faded. The bite finished with an intense burst of dark chocolate, softened by the buttery dissolution of caramel. What I mean here, there was a temporal aspect to the bar, a sense of evanescence and persistence. Because of the random placement of the almonds and dark chocolate, each bite offered a distinct combination. It was like eating several different bars at once.
Sir, I think you have an addiction.
I think he'd be the first guy to admit probably that that's true.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, part of the point of the book is to get people to appreciate you know, you appreciate vanilla. You realize how miraculous it is that we have such an amazing flavor. It's so aromatic, it's so subtle, and it's powerful. And that's what I want people to be, is I don't want to try to stop people from consuming candy, though obviously morally I recognize it's not the greatest thing for the world economy. But I want people, as long as we're gonna eat candy and give ourselves that pleasure, I want people to be really conscious of the experience of the world in their mouth. You know, not embarrassed by it, but really to embrace the miraculous tastes and textures that we're lucky enough to have these days.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Others welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You know, we could go out and we could get a little baby, and if we dropped a drop of something sweet on her tongue, she will smile. And at the same time, if you take something bitter or sour and drop a drop of that on her tongue, you'll scrunch your face up and make that ew face, and we know exactly what that means. So obviously we're primed from maybe from coming out of the womb to like sweet stuff.
Sure.
But now you're taking this to an extreme, and I know that it's something that you meditate on, why it is that this has become just something that has obsessed you. Why do you think that for some people, they are candy freaks? And I know you say you think that a lot of people are freakish about something, and we'll stipulate that. But, you know, why candy, and why for you?
Well, I think some of it is genetic predisposition. I think here of my nephew, Daniel Augustino, age three, just turned three. He wakes up 7 a.m. He's, you know, not just barely three now, walks into my brother and sister-in-law's room and coughs, fakes coughing, actually, because he knows that at 7 in the morning, the closest he can get to something sweet, to a piece of candy, is in fact a cough drop. Now, that nobody has taught him to like candy. He hasn't developed any emotional or psychological dynamic around candy. He just has the freak bloodline. So part of it I'm going to cop to sort of just genetic good or bad luck, however you view it. But I would also say that people do make there's a powerful psychological and emotional connection that is made, you know, and it's sort of a cliche, you know, the woman or man who's just been broken up with, you know, eating bonbons in the bath or whatever. But I do think that we use food in this culture, in every culture, as comfort. And we also, to a large extent, use food as energy. And candy is the purest form of both of those. We get a burst of energy. Our mood is elevated. There are all these psychoactive chemicals in chocolate that really do contribute to our feeling better about things. It's a form of self-medication. And for me, I think, as you're identifying somewhat bluntly, it went probably beyond the, it certainly went beyond the wholesome nutritionally and probably to some extent psychologically as well. I really, candy kind of kept me company. I mean, I can remember very distinctly buying candy, and it would be my afternoon activity, and I would take it into my room and I would put it on my bed and I would sort of play with it, and in the same way that other kids would play with toy soldiers or dolls or something, I was sitting there playing with candy. Now, I want to say that I don't just like every candy indiscriminately, and I almost feel like out of fairness, I would like to read a short section about the candies that I truly despise.
Oh, that the mistakes were made?
Yes, indeed.
All right, yes.
So the one candy whose success is most puzzling to me in the entire world is Twizzlers. Twizzlers is basically an imitation of red licorice, a flavor which in itself has no cognate in the natural world. The defenders of this candy will probably object at this point, arguing that the most popular Twizzlers flavor is actually strawberry. In fact, Twizzlers bears roughly the same chemical relationship to strawberry as the Vienna sausage does to filet mignon, which is to say none. Its flavor is so completely artificial that I've often wondered if the production staff might not endeavor to make it just a little bit more artificial tasting, thus crossing over an invisible flavor threshold and allowing the product to start tasting less artificial. This is to say nothing of the Twizzler's texture, which falls somewhere between chitin and rain poncho. As a former Tangy Taffy user, I realize I'm not exactly on solid ground as an arbiter of taste, but I can at least plead youthful indiscretion on that count, whereas I continue to encounter grown men and women, some of them otherwise desirable, who blithely chomp at their Twizzler's cud, breathing their plasticine reek onto the rest of us. to me, Twizzlers belongs to the same loathsome genus as the jujube. The young and fortunate reader may not have heard of jujubes, and this candy will be hard to describe in a fashion that makes them sound suitable for human consumption. They were basically hard pellets, the size and shape of pencil erasers. Indeed, if one were to set jujubes beside pencil erasers in a blind taste test, it would be tough to make a distinction, except that pencil erasers have more natural fruit flavor. And I'll just read a couple of examples of candies that I refer to as MWMs, mistakes were made. Marshmallow Peeps, a candy that encourages the notion that it is acceptable to eat child offspring, composed of marshmallow dyed yellow and sprinkled with sugar. Circus Peanuts, again, a marshmallow pretending to be something else, this time a legume. Boston Baked Beans, and here this is a direct address to the baked bean. If you are an actual peanut, why are you not covered in chocolate? Why are you covered instead in some kind of burnt-tasting brick red shell? Is the idea that you resemble a baked bean supposed to make you more alluring? Chuckles, a fruit jelly the consistency of cartilage. Explain. And I go on and on here with lists of candies that truly offend my sensibility, last but not least being coconut and white chocolate, which I find especially loathsome.
Chuckles, I think, actually used to be made in a factory not very far from here, and I
don't. Sorry to hear that.
Is Chuckles still available?
Yes, they're still produced, and I must say, in defense of Chuckles, that there is a group of people out there, the same people who are probably chomping away at Twizzlers, who are devout and devoted fans of the Chuckle.
Hmm.
And I don't know what to say to them. In fact, I have nothing to say to them other than have at it. You know, leave the good stuff for me.
Well, I do. In fact, I do remember Chuckles. That's another thing I guess I remember from my childhood. Not that I was enthusiastic, but if that's all there was, well, you know.
Right.
And the other thing I remember is that each Chuckle came in a different color, which was presumably a different flavor, and one of them was licorice.
Yeah.
And I didn't like licorice when I was a kid, so my grandfather, who did, actually, he always got the black Chuckle.
Yes.
I took it out of there and gave it to him.
It is one of those flavors that is a big divisive element. There, you either love the black Chuckle or you hate the black Chuckle. I would say a similar concept is you love the clove Necco, the purple Necco, which is clove-flavored, or you hate the clove Necco. Most people, I'd say 90%, despise the black Chuckle, despise the clove Necco, the purple Necco. But there's 10% who are, you know, just absolutely as enthusiastic as everybody else is disgusted. And, you know, it's a little bit like I'm left-handed. You know, I feel like, okay, you're in the minority, but you're going to, in some sense, it's like sort of a badge of pride. Anybody who can stand a black Chuckle, I say, hey, you know, you should have everybody's.
We're talking again this morning with Steve Almond. His book is Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. He teaches creative writing at Boston College, and the book is a lot of fun. Whether indeed you are a candy freak or not, we have a couple of callers here. Let's talk to them. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Well, my mother was Swiss, so I was brought up to despise Hershey's because Swiss chocolate is, there's nothing like it, although I am very fond of Belgian chocolate.
Oh.
And I lived in Germany during the 70s, and I thought German chocolate was quite good as well.
Very good.
And when I came back to the States in 77 to Champaign-Urbana, the Aldi, we seem to have brought it with us. I don't know if you're familiar with that chain. It's a European chain that's kind of like a discount, no-frills grocery store, one brand, always an off-brand of each kind of thing.
Sure. I know there's Lindt that's quite a popular brand that you can find in almost any grocery store now.
Yeah. Well, the Aldi had their own because I thought it was a German store, but somebody told me it was Dutch. But anyway, they would have German chocolate when they first came. They would have German chocolate during the Christmas season.
Yes.
100-gram bars for like 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
But they've stopped doing that. But there's another issue that I've recently become aware of, and that is fair trade cocoa, just like fair trade coffee.
Sure.
Because I understand that 70% of the cocoa is grown in three countries in Africa where slavery is either tolerated or not outlawed.
Yep.
The Ivory Coast and
Ghana, right.
And two neighboring countries. So I wonder if you'd just talk about that briefly. And
sure. It's mentioned in the book, and this is, as I alluded to before, thank you for bringing this up. You know, candy is, and chocolate in particular, has always been, you know, predicated on cheap labor to do the difficult work of growing and farming and so forth. And as people have become aware with globalization of the, you know, where a bar comes from in the first world, where in the developing world it actually originated from, the fact that there, for instance, in the Ivory Coast, there have been a number of reports of parents essentially selling their children into indentured servitude to work these chocolate plantations, because the cocoa plantations are very labor intensive. And I would say this about that: there, you should be checking, if you're concerned about such things. In this country, the way we vote is with our money, and you know that sounds crass, but that's really true. That's how capitalism works. So if you feel that is a concern, as you should, then check and make sure that, you know, you're buying chocolate that's fair trade, and do the things that you can do by way of telling Nestle and Mars and Hershey's that you don't want, you know, sort of blood on your chocolate, so to speak. It is a real big issue, and it's something that I, as a candy freak, kind of grapple with, because I don't want to give up the pleasure of eating. You know, it's one of the great pleasures of my life, but I also, as a kind of lefty who feels bad about our America's sort of pigging of the world's resources, I also don't want to contribute to the problem mindlessly. So I tend to try to look for, if I can, to find chocolates that are fair trade. And I can recommend a great chocolate to you. It's just terrific, and it's made in Grenada, and it's owned by Grenadans, and they work on this very very small. Plot of cocoa trees, and they produce it all themselves in their own factory. And I think if you go to www.grenadachocolate.com, you will find they have two bars, a 60% and I think a 70% cocoa mass, which are really fine chocolate. And they've got, especially the 60% bar, has an incredible flavor, a little coffee, hints of cherry, and I think you can buy them online, and they're really fabulous chocolate. So that's maybe a solution to the guilt but desire for chocolate problem.
I just want to say, for people who are here locally, the Common Ground Food Co-op, which is an Illinois Disciples Foundation, does have some fair trade chocolate.
Good. Well, the thing for people to do really is to, you know, to say to your grocery store, hey, I want to buy, you know, chocolate from you, but I want you to stock this stuff. Because as I say, you know, we can write about it and protest in the streets and so forth, but you vote with your dollars in this country, and that's what people should do if they want, as they should, for there to be socially responsible chocolate, if such a thing could exist.
And you can also get it at greatergood.com, and then there's another brand, Jungle Chocolate, that I think you can get there. That's
terrific.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
All right, thanks.
Let's go here to the next caller, and I believe that would be someone in Savoy, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, hi. I'm on the cell phone.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention something which is extremely important, and I say this having just eaten Chuckles yesterday. I didn't like them, I have to say. But one of the things that makes people like Chuckles and like Twizzlers is it's a texture thing.
Yeah.
I used to only eat Juicy Fruits if they were at least 3 weeks old.
Yes.
And,
well, this is a great point, and I want to mention as a foremost example of this, that there's an entire community of people who can get into a long, heated argument about the appropriate time that you should allow Peeps to cure or become stale before you consume them. You know, I have taken part in such crazy discussions, even though I myself hate Peeps, and some will say, well, you should wait a week, and others would say, a week, yeah, they don't get nearly chewy enough. You need to wait a month,
right,
and so forth.
Yeah. I just really wanted to mention one other thing, which is that I had something catastrophic happen to me 5 years ago, which it was that as a result of taking certain heart medicines, I totally lost the ability to eat, taste sweet, anything sweet.
Oh, my
and
gracious.
Yeah, I know, and I grew up in Coney Island, the sweet capital of the world, back in the 50s.
Wow.
And one thing which I noticed, other than the fact that I lost 35 pounds because I didn't want to eat anything,
right,
was that sweet isn't just a flavor or a taste that people like. Sweetness is used to disguise bitterness.
Wow.
You take a cola and you take away the sweet, what you have left is one of the most dreadful things I have ever tasted.
Wow.
And this has become very important in the industry where you're finding that it's just that you lose sweet, but what you do is you bring out some flavors that you might not like at all.
Yeah.
And so, actually,
well, this is, you know, this is the very reason, in fact, you know, the very reason that spices were so crucial. In the Middle Ages, you needed spices because there was no refrigeration. Half the meat they were eating had started to turn, you know, so you had to have these, you know, pepper and salt just as a way of making food palatable. You know, that is part of the purpose of spices, is to disguise other flavors that are naturally, this particularly bitterness, that are naturally, you know, your palate is going
to
revolt.
I just want you to know that I envy you and I dislike you as well.
Well, listen, read the book. You'll dislike me even more.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call. Let's go have a call over in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I don't know whether you remember a bar called the Three Musketeers.
Oh, well, of course.
Is it still around? I'm not sure.
Well, let me tell you about the Three Musketeers because it's fascinating. Three Musketeers is very much still around. And it's essentially at this point just a brick of chocolate nougat covered in milk chocolate. But the reason, are you old enough to remember the original,
yes,
Three Musketeers?
Yes, back in the 30s it first came out, and there were three separate little bars of different flavor.
Chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. And in fact, you know, people don't understand now why it's called Three Musketeers, and this is a great example of a kind of homogenizing of the bars. They went with the most popular flavor, which was chocolate nougat. It was cheaper to produce. It was less trouble. But, boy, I wish I could have been around for the days where you had a strawberry nougat inside the Three Musketeers bar.
Yeah, there were three flavors.
Yeah, did they taste good?
Oh, yes. But I don't know. I think it may have been before the war, and maybe it went to war, you know, to become this single bar.
Yeah. Well, it's just a matter of production costs in many cases. You know, and I do think that the big bars out there, you know, Snickers, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, the Hershey bar with almonds and so forth, I think these are really terrific candy bars. I'm not going to, for 65 cents or whatever they cost, that's a great deal. That's a lot of happiness for that amount of money. But there were really amazing flavors. You were probably alive. Do you remember some of the crazy other brands and how many different brands there used to be back in the 30s?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they used pineapple flavors, they used a lot of cherry and orange flavors, figs, they didn't just use caramel, there was a lot of marshmallow, nougats, fondants, creams, taffies, you know, there was just a greater diversity, and what you found actually was that in particular regions, you would get more ingredients from that particular region. So for instance, in Idaho, of all places, there would be huckleberry bars because huckleberries are, you know, indigenous to Idaho. Mm-hmm. And I must say, although this is a shameless product plug, that Dave Wagers, who runs the Idaho Candy Company, which makes the Idaho Spud, it's one of the regional factories I visited, is reintroducing a huckleberry bar. And here's the piece. I hope you're sitting down because this, to me, is miraculous, especially if you've ever tasted huckleberry, which has such an intense flavor. It's wonderful. It's actual huckleberries surrounded by a huckleberry cream and then slivered almonds, which have been oil fried. That is all drizzled with milk chocolate, and there's a little dab of white chocolate that's colored purple right at the top of it. It sounds like an amazing bar. I'm hoping he's going to call it the Huckleberry Finn.
Well, I hope it won't cost a dollar.
Well, unfortunately, because it's got almonds and it's going to be tough to produce, it probably will be a little bit more expensive, but he's never going to put out, these regional companies are never going to try to be gourmet bars, you know.
Well, speaking of regional, you've already discussed the Heath bar, I'm sure.
Well, we haven't discussed the Heath bar, but that's a great bar as well, you know, the butter toffee bar.
Well, that's very local here, you see, and it... Recently, I mean, it was an independent company until fairly recently.
Yeah.
I think Hershey bought it.
Yes, Hershey's bought it up, and there was a brand that competed with the Heath bar called the Score, which was actually a Scandinavian bar that Hershey's, I think, introduced back sometime in the in the early 90s or late 80s. But the Heath is a terrific bar as well, there's no question. And they're a good example of a company that for many years was independent. And it's just very, it's almost impossible for these small companies to, you know, to survive. The box chocolate companies, to Fannie Mae going under just recently. You can look at almost any city in America, and they used to have a local confectioner that no longer exists. That's what made it so special for me to visit, you know, Cypher's Vallow Milk in Kansas City, and Dave Wagers with the Idaho Spud up in Boise, and Marty Palmer, who makes the Twin Bing, a delicious cherry and chocolate peanut candy bar that's made in Sioux City. It was kind of like visiting factories as they would have existed back in the 30s or 40s or 50s.
And I think one of the things you explain in the book is that you would have gone to one of the big three or the big three factories if they would let you, but they don't. They're obsessed because, I guess, in the candy industry, especially the big guys, there's actually industrial espionage because you can't patent a candy bar. And if you wanted to make a copy of somebody else's bar, you'd have to call it something different, but there's no reason why you can't.
Precisely, and people have to remember that the ingredients are so similar. I mean, most candy bars, as rhapsodic as I can be about them, most candy bars boil down to chocolate, caramel, some kind of nut, usually peanuts, maybe nougat, you know. That's the vast majority, peanut butter. You know, that's the vast majority of our candy bars. So there is incredible paranoia. In Mars, for instance, if a machine breaks and they need to call somebody from outside the plant to fix it, they blindfold the worker, lead them to the place, the panel they need to fix. They do the work, they blindfold them and lead them out.
That's a great, I love that story. That just shows you the level of concern that they must have.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's all about getting, with candy, it's all about getting the bar into people's mouths. That's why most Americans like Hershey's, because Milton S. Hershey got his chocolate into our mouths, you know, at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. And that's how you develop taste.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We could go another hour, I'm sure. The book is a lot of fun. There's more like that in the book, Candy Freak. So if we have now got you excited, go out and get a chocolate and get the book by our guest, Steve Almond. He teaches creative writing at Boston College. Thanks very much, Steve.
Oh, it was my pleasure.